the process, he was clothed only in his underwear, and lifted the lid off the tray. Garlic soup and roasted chicken, and could it be? He picked up a breaded ball and bit into it. Yes, fruit dumplings. All of it exactly like how his Czechoslovakian-born grandmother used to make them. With his head still impaired, he didn't realize what feeding him such a personal meal said about his captors. Rosario went from unconscious to full alert without any stops in between. It was a habit she'd learned growing up in the preacher's house. There were times when he'd come into her room in the middle of the night and yank her out of bed, yelling at her about chores he said she hadn't done that she actually had. She'd discovered early on that if she displayed even the tiniest bit of sluggishness before doing what he demanded, he would bring out his switch and her backside would be red for days. So she quickly learned how to leave sleep behind in an instant. Her second life benefited from this ability, too. She'd lost count of how many times waking in a flash had saved her from being robbed or beaten or raped, especially in her first year in Mexico City, before she'd found safer places to live. Whatever room she was in now was pitch black and dead quiet. She clicked her tongue softly against the roof of her mouth. No echo, meaning the space was small. With care, she lifted her arm straight up and then moved them slowly to either side, as if she were doing a yoga move. Her left arm touched the wall before it reached the 45-degree mark. Her right, however, went all the way down until her bicep was lying beside her on the mattress. She let it continue down until the tip of her index finger brushed the floor. As she brought her right arm back up, she felt a tiny point of tightness in the crook of her elbow. She rubbed it and discovered a small bump. The area surrounding it was sore, too. It could have been a cut, but from its location and size, she was pretty sure it was a needle mark. She assessed her body for other irregularities, but found nothing other than the fact she was almost nude. When she set her feet on the floor, it was cold and felt like metal. Using the same careful approach she'd employed earlier, she determined the room was 2 meters wide by 3 long. She also found a shelf with clothes on it, a t-shirt it felt like, and jeans that, when she pulled them on, were a perfect fit. Not long after she dressed, the lights came on, and a loud whistle screeched from a speaker in the ceiling. A few minutes later, a tray of what she assumed was food slid into the room. She didn't check. She'd already been drugged at least once, so until her stomach twisted with hunger pains, she wasn't going to consume anything. Instead, she sat on the bed and stared at the door. Liesl slept through the whistle and panel opening and the tray being pushed into her room. She woke 2 hours later, rested, no headache, and momentarily believing she was in her hotel room at the Wolf Casino. But reality quickly returned in an avalanche of crushing memories. The assistant catering manager's office, the gunshot, the head wound, the hospital, the police, and the man who'd said he was Liesl's lawyer. Finally, the mental assault eased enough for her to notice the silence. Where were the beeps of the hospital equipment? And the odor of medicine? The bed felt different, too. She opened her eyes and looked around. What the hell? 14. Office of the Administrator. Despite the death of a committee member and the last-minute field team substitution, everything was progressing within the expected parameters. The four candidates had been woken from their induced sleep, Ananka's the longest at 6 days, and Liesl's the shortest at 13 hours, in preparation for the final stage of recruitment. Due to the special circumstances surrounding the fifth candidate and the fact he would not be necessary on the Fairbanks mission, the administrator had decided to let him stay where he was until a more appropriate job came along. The administrator checked the recruitment schedule and was about to alert the monitoring team that they would begin shortly when a bong from his computer signaled a request for a video chat from Committee Member Tuesday. The administrator clicked accept.
Good afternoon, sir. Good afternoon. I know you're quite busy, but I wanted to confirm that the field team was in place.
Though the man's tone was businesslike, the administrator noticed an underlying concern bordering on panic in Tuesday's disposition.
Our recruits are in place, yes, but we have not yet begun orientation.
Why not? Shouldn't that happen right away?
Pardon me, Mr. Tuesday. You should have received a copy of the schedule, did you not?
I have it. I just thought...
He paused, as if resetting himself.
I only wanted to confirm where things stood.
Orientation will commence in the next few hours.
And how long until they are operational?
That, too, was in the schedule, but the administrator replied, 4 days, as long as they accept our offers.
The schedule needs to be sped up.
I'm sorry?
And we need to change the mission.
Caught by surprise, the administrator took a moment before saying, I don't understand. Change to what?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Fairbanks job isn't time critical.
That's not precisely true.
What I mean is, the mission doesn't need to happen immediately and can be put off for a week or two if necessary.
The administrator worked hard to keep from frowning. Technically, that's correct, but the same is true for all the proposed missions.
I'm not talking about switching to one of the other choices. I'm talking about something entirely new that is time-sensitive.
Tuesday explained what he meant, finishing with,
I'm sure you can see that this is an even better test case for the field team than Fairbanks, and there's no question that it fits within the goals of the committee.
The administrator considered his response. It's indeed a troubling situation, he said, and, as you say, a suitable mission to undertake. But there are rules the committee must operate under. If we ignore them, the program will quickly fall apart.
Call the committee into a special session. Let us vote on it. I'll stand by the decision.
Very well. Mr. Tuesday, I am informing you that from this point forward, our conversation is being recorded. The truth, of course, was that the recording had been on since the start of the call. Are you formally requesting an emergency meeting of the committee?
Yes, damn it. Yes. That's exactly what I'm doing.
Your request has been registered. Per committee rules, I will convene the meeting at the earliest possible time.
Now would be best.
I'm sure you understand that is not in my control, but I will do everything I can to make it happen as soon as possible. Looking frustrated but resigned, Tuesday said,
Of course, I understand. It's... Never mind.
Just so we're clear, Mr. Tuesday, I will also need to verify the events as you've presented them.
I'll send you everything I have.
One final question. As you know, committee rules are very clear on a separation between ourselves and the missions we take on. I apologize for saying this, but your demeanor makes me wonder if you have a personal connection to this. The lie flowed from Tuesday's eyes to his face as he donned a more detached expression.
Of course not, it's just... Things like this, they affect me right here.
He patted his chest above his heart.
Admittedly, more than they probably should.
I understand. The administrator called his boss and succinctly relayed the details of his conversation with Tuesday.
I agree, Monday said after the administrator finished. Tuesday must have a connection to this. We need to find out what it is. But I'll tell you what troubles me most. It is far too convenient that this alternate mission just happens to come up not only right when the field team is being assembled, but when they are also nearby.
I had the same thought, the administrator said. We might not be able to dig up Tuesday's connection soon enough to avoid an emergency meeting, but what I could do is recommend to the committee that we don't make the change for any number of practical reasons. At this point, I think they'll follow whatever I suggest. Monday was silent for a moment.
They would, but I don't want you to do that. If this legitimately needs our attention, I want you to recommend it, and I want the committee to vote for the switch. This is an opportunity for you and me, not a complication. If there is someone working against us through Tuesday, this could provide us with the means of finding out who they are.
Whether he's aware of being used or not, if Tuesday has a tie to this, he will need to be replaced.
Yes, he will.
2 empty committee seats in a matter of weeks. The administrator did not like that at all. Should we pass on a warning to the other members to be more vigilant?
No. If they're not vigilant enough at this point, they don't deserve to be part of our work. Now, if there's nothing else, I have other...
Just one more thing, sir. Given the nature of the new mission, it would probably be a good idea to bring in the hunter.
I concur. Bring him in. 23 minutes after the administrator confirmed the details of Tuesday's proposal, the committee convened via video conference. The vote to switch missions was 6-0 in favor. 15. Elsewhere. Warren was in Avanti's office again.
"They've taken the bait," he said.
"As I knew they would."
Avanti clasped his hands and set them on the desk.
"And the babysitters? I'm assuming everything is under control."
"They've reached the encampment and have transferred the cargo to the shelter."
"Good. You've made it clear how they should proceed?"
"Yes, sir. McGowan has his orders on when to escalate."
"And the child?"
"I personally made it clear that she's not to be handed over under any circumstances. Once everything has run its course, she will be brought to us." Avanti nodded and said,
"Please tell Ms. Richmond I'll have my lunch on the patio."
16. Another tray slid into Ananka's cell several hours after her first meal had been delivered. Once more, the food was familiar. A raw kale salad with the blackened tofu she always requested at the vegan restaurant a few miles from her home in Boulder. If her captors were going to continue torturing her with food she loved, that was fine by her. After she finished eating, she spent a half hour stretching, her body still sore and stiff, and then lay down on the bed. Somewhere in the middle of thinking about a job she'd done the previous fall, she dozed off for about 20 minutes, the normal length of one of her cat naps. She yawned, sat up, and froze. The door to her room was wide open. She peered through the doorway. The subdued lighting on the other side kept her from being able to determine how big the room was. She could see only that the space right outside her room was empty. Slowly, she approached the door, increasing her view of the room outside, but it remained unoccupied. This is just plain weird. Though logically, she knew no one would be waiting to jump her since she was already a prisoner. She tensed as she stepped across the threshold. Of course, nothing happened. She was the only person in what turned out to be a wide circular room. 11 other doors, identical to hers, were spread around the space in groups of three. Hers was the only one open. Between each group was an open entrance to what appeared to be a hallway. Three of them were dark, but the fourth was not only brightly lit, it also had a line of undulating LED lights embedded in the floor, rippling inward. She stepped over to the closed door just left of hers. A chest-high heavy metal bar lay across it, secured in place by an electronic lock. She knocked. "Anyone in there?" Not a peep from inside. Maybe she was the only prisoner. For a second, she considered checking the other doors, but screw that, she thought. She wouldn't learn anything from someone who'd also been locked up. What she needed was a jailer. She checked the dark hallway entrance closest to her and found it went only 10 feet before being walled off by a temporary-looking metal wall. She skipped the other two dark entrances, entered the lit hallway, half expecting a wall to open up into a Rube Goldberg killing machine that she'd have 30 seconds to defeat to keep from dying. Thankfully, the walls remained walls, and the only killing was going on in her head as she imagined what she was going to do to those who'd taken her prisoner. She followed the moving LEDs down the hall. She passed several exits along the way, but all were blocked off by the same kind of metal wall she'd seen in the dark hallway. About 50 feet in, the hall took an elbow turn to the left, went on for another 30 feet or so before it and the rippling lights stopped at a set of double doors. Feeling like a fish on a hook, she contemplated going back to her cell, but there were no answers there, so with extreme reluctance, she pulled one of the doors open and looked inside. If she had created a list of the kind of spaces she expected to find, a conference room would not even have made the cut, but that's exactly what was on the other side of the doorway. Dominating the center of the space was a large rectangular table surrounded by 5 chairs, one directly in front of her and 2 on each side. Like in her cell, there were no windows or additional exits. She stepped onto the threshold and held the door wide while she looked around, but she was the only one there. As she moved the rest of the way in, she reached around for the handle on the back of the door to keep it open, but there was no handle. The door slammed shut before she could grab it. Annoyed, she searched along the edges for enough surface to pull on, but everything fit together too well. She looked back into the room. Crap. Dylan shot through the open cell doorway the moment he realized he was no longer locked in, and paused in the circular room just long enough for a quick look around. The second he spotted the lit corridor, he ran to it. He didn't care if he was being led somewhere or not. In fact, he didn't even give it a thought. The only thing important to him was finding a way out. When he reached the double doors at the end, he yanked them open and rushed in. Unfortunately, he had not anticipated finding furniture in the middle of his path. While he avoided the chair at the end of the table, he could not avoid the table itself and slammed belly first into the edge. Clutching his gut, he stumbled backward, groaning, and was completely unprepared when someone flew into him and knocked him to the ground. He yelled out as he hit the floor. Hands on his shoulders rolled him onto his back, and before he could react, a woman who looked like a tall Thandi Newton straddled his aching stomach, pressed her hands against his shoulders, and tucked her legs back so her feet hooked around his thighs. Lowering her face until it was only a few inches from his, she growled, "How do I get out of here? I'm having a hard time breathing. Can you let up a little?" His request garnered him the exact opposite of what he wanted. "Answer the question." "How the hell would I know?" Her eyes narrowed. "Why are you holding me here? You think I... If you don't tell me what I want to know, I will kill you. Do you understand?" "Yeah, but... Answer me." "I can't. I'm not holding you. I'm the one who's being held." Uncertainty rippled through her eyes. She eased up on his torso enough for him to catch his breath. "Held where?" "In a damn cell for I don't know how long," he said, his voice strained by the fact she was still on top of him. "I wake up and the door's open, so I decided to try to find a way out, and then you body slam me like we're starring in WrestleMania. I'm not the one who needs to answer questions, you are."
"Maybe you're saying that just to trick me."
"Oh, for Christ's sake, think what you want, but can you do it someplace that's not on top of me?"
Rosario searched every inch of the round room before she ventured into the lit hallway. Her most interesting finds were the two other open doors that led into cells identical to hers. From the crumpled bedding, it was clear both had been recently occupied. She entered the hallway and inched along, alert for any sounds. Each time she came to one of the doorways covered by metal drop-down walls, she placed her ear against it. Not once did she hear anything on the other side. When she did the same upon reaching the double doors, she heard a rhythmic squeak. She eased the door toward her until the gap was wide enough to step through. Before she could,
"Don't let it shut!"
The shout came from a tall woman standing beside a long table in the center of the room. Sitting on the opposite side was a man twirling in a chair that squeaked every few seconds. When the woman started moving toward her, Rosario pulled back into the hallway and started to shut the door.
"No!"
the woman yelled, halting.
"Please, don't lock us in here!"
Rosario stopped, but stayed ready to shove the door closed if anyone made a wrong move.
"Who are you?"
"If you're hoping to get a name out of her,
good luck to you,"
the man said, his accent Irish.
"She's not much for sharing. I'm Dylan. Dylan Brody."
"Did you just come out of one of the cells?" the woman asked. Rosario kept her expression blank and said nothing. "I was the first one out," the woman said, "about 30 minutes ago. This idiot stumbled in here 15 minutes ago."
"Literally,"
the man tossed in.
"And now you."
The woman motioned toward the table. 5 chairs. "If the pattern holds, someone else will show up in another 15 minutes, and someone else another 15 after that."
"Why?"
Rosario asked.
The man grunted a laugh. "Ain't that the question of the afternoon, or evening? Hell, or morning? Do either of you know what time it is?"
Rosario looked back and forth between Dylan and the woman.
"So it's just the two of you? You haven't seen anyone else?"
"Just you," the woman said. Rosario eyed them for a moment and then glanced at the inside of the door. No handle.
"Either of you have something we can jam this open with?"
she asked. Her question seemed to relax the woman,
Use one of your shoes, Dylan said.
I'd rather use one of yours, Rosario countered.
Ha! I don't think so. I'll hold on to both of mine if you don't.
Give her a shoe, the woman said.
Why me? Did your mother not teach you any manners?
Dylan groaned, pulled off one of his shoes, and tossed it toward the open door.
There you go. Everyone happy?
Rosario opened the door all the way and jammed the toe of the shoe under it until the door wouldn't budge.
Hey now, Dylan said, rising from his chair. I still gotta wear that.
Rosario cautiously walked into the room, stopping several feet from the other woman. Petite to begin with, Rosario felt like a hobbit next to her. There had to be at least a 20-centimeter difference between them, and who knew how many kilos.
I didn't get your name, Rosario said.
And I didn't get yours.
They looked at each other, eyes locked, neither willing to go first.
Oh, for the love of God, Dylan said. You're worse than the boys back at school.
As if they'd been practicing it for hours, Rosario and the woman simultaneously said,
Shut up, Dylan.
The corner of the woman's mouth ticked up. Ananka, she said, holding out a hand. After a pause, Rosario took it.
Rosario.
Liesl saw the open door as soon as she woke and knew it had not been left open by accident. Therefore, walking through it would be doing her captor's bidding. She had no idea why she had been brought here or what her captor's intentions might be, but she did know she wasn't going to do anything to make their lives easy, so she sat cross-legged on the bed and proceeded to meditate. At some point, the whistle blared from the speaker in the ceiling again, and then sounded off a third time a few minutes after that, but she was so deep in her nothingness that the intrusions were barely noted. The footsteps, however, those she did hear. A resonating whistle like the one that had initially awoken Ananka screamed through the propped open doorway into the conference room.
Sounds like another guest just got up, Dylan said.
Ananka frowned. A whistle didn't wake me this time.
Me neither, Rosario said.
Come to think of it, I also didn't hear one, Dylan said.
Ananka walked over to the doorway and peered down the hall. A moment later, Rosario and Dylan joined her.
Taking their time, aren't they? Dylan said.
Rosario turned and studied him for a second.
You like to talk.
Though it obviously wasn't a compliment, Dylan beamed.
Well, I am Irish.
The whistle went off again. Ananka exchanged a look with Rosario. Perhaps someone should check it out. She turned to Dylan.
Me?
He asked. I was thinking more that you could stay here in case someone else shows up.
Alone? I don't think so. I think it's better if we all stick together for now, don't you?
He has a point, Rosario said.
They headed down the hall, Ananka first, and then Rosario, and finally, a few steps behind, Dylan.
Not sure this is such a good idea, Dylan whispered.
Ananka turned to tell him to be quiet, but saw that a glare from Rosario had already taken care of the problem. They paused at the entrance to the round room. Four doors were open now. Ananka pointed at her cell and then at herself. Rosario indicated which was hers, and Dylan nodded toward his. That left only the open door at their 2 o'clock unaccounted for. Ananka mimed what she thought they should do. Rosario considered it and then nodded. Ananka looked at Dylan, who gave her a, sure, why not, you're not going to listen to me anyway, shrug. Instead of heading straight toward the open door, they went left to a spot directly across from it. Ananka's eyebrow rose when she spotted the woman sitting on the bed inside, legs crossed. One of her hands relaxed on a knee. The other appeared to be strapped across her chest. Rosario and Dylan looked as perplexed as Ananka felt. There didn't appear to be any danger, so they approached the doorway. The woman looked half Asian and half Caucasian. Ananka guessed she was a few inches shorter than herself, but it was hard to tell with the woman sitting as she was. Ananka could see the woman's arm was indeed restrained. No cast, though, which made her wonder if something had happened to the woman's shoulder and not the arm itself. Dislocated, perhaps? Surprisingly, the woman still hadn't opened her eyes.
I think the idea is that you're supposed to come out of there, Dylan said loudly into the room.
Ananka shot him an annoyed look.
What? Someone had to say something sometime.
The sitting woman made no indication she'd heard him.
Maybe she's sleeping,
Dylan whispered.
You really do not know how to shut up, do you?
Rosario said.
She's one of us. Why should I be quiet?
The sitting woman suddenly breathed deeply and moved her free hand into her lap. Eyes still closed, she said in German-accented English,
What do you mean, one of us?
With an I-told-you-so smile, Dylan said,
We're cell buddies.
The woman parted her eyelids.
I'm Dylan,
he said, stepping into the doorway.
And this is Rosario, and the tall one's Ananka. Who might you be?
The woman untangled her legs and walked over to the toilet. As she started to unbutton her pants, she glanced back at them.
If you do not mind.
Oh, right, sure. They moved away from the door so the woman would have some privacy. The moment the toilet flushed, a male voice boomed from ceiling speakers scattered throughout the circular room.
Please make your way back to the conference room. We will begin in a few minutes.
Dylan looked up at the ceiling and yelled,
Begin what?
There was no response. 17. Ananka sat down in the chair at the end of the conference table, while Rosario took one of those on the right and Dylan one on the left. A few moments later, the woman from the fourth cell warily entered the room.
Glad you decided to join us, Dylan said.
He tapped the seat next to him.
You can sit by me. I'm the friendly one.
She considered him for no more than a second and then took the chair next to Rosario.
Is it because I haven't showered?
He smelled under his arm.
Ew, definitely. Good call on your part.
The lights dimmed and the wall directly opposite Ananka split down the middle and slid out of sight, revealing a floor-to-ceiling wall-to-wall screen. On it was the image of a man behind a desk, facing them. Short brown hair, graying on the sides. Ananka put him somewhere between late 40s and early 50s, and his stylish dark gray suit, black shirt, and black tie marked him as a man who likely didn't buy clothes off a rack. His hands sat on the desk, palms down, a stack of files between them.
Good morning, he said.
Who the hell are you?
Rosario asked.
And why are you holding us prisoner?
You are not prisoners. You are under our protection.
Dylan guffawed.
Protection? That's why you locked us away in those tiny closets?
The recovery rooms are no larger than they need to be. One does not need a penthouse suite when one is unconscious.
How long were we out?
Ananka asked.
Different for each of you. Mr. Brody has been out for 4 days.
Four? Dylan said.
Are you kidding me?
I am not.
4 days gone, Dylan scoffed. That explains my headache, then.
No, your reaction to the medication explains your headache. We would have used something else, but there was nothing in your records to indicate your particular intolerance.
Oh, you want to talk about intolerance, do you? I can...
How long was I out?
Rosario asked.
Just a little less than Mr. Brody. Fraulein Kessler has been with us for 22 hours.
And me? Ananka said.
7 days.
She'd been out for a whole week? That meant it had been 11 days since she fled Manila.
What the hell are we doing here?
You are here because each of your lives was in danger.
In danger? Dylan said. What are you talking about? My life wasn't in danger.
That van you were driving, do you know what you were transporting? Dylan grinned.
Of course I do. Flowers.
Under the flowers, beneath the fake floor, and in the van's walls.
Look, it's not my job to know what the cargo is.
You're just the courier, the man said.
Damn right.
The man pulled a file from his stack and opened it. Your van was lined with C4, nearly 400 pounds of it.
I'm sure it's not the first time, Dylan said with an it's no big deal shrug.
But he couldn't keep the concern from creasing his brow. What would someone do with 400 pounds of stolen plastic explosive? The man asked.
You don't need to answer, I'll tell you.
You were to deliver the van to an expediter who had been hired to obtain it for an organization I believe you are familiar with. ISIL, Daesh, whatever you want to call them.
No, no, that can't be true. I would never involve myself with them.
How would you know? You were just the courier. The explosives were supposed to be on their way to Berlin an hour after you delivered them. You, of course, would never have had the chance to know this, because you'd have been dead not long after you arrived. They wouldn't have chanced you connecting them to the delivery.
The man closed the file and put his hand on it.
The proof is right here. You will be given a copy, along with audio recordings and video footage that should alleviate any doubts.
Looking uncomfortable, Dylan said,
Well, even if you're right, they didn't receive the cargo.
Also true, and they are none too happy about that. You are, as they say, on the run. But don't worry. We do have several solutions for you to choose from that should get you out of trouble.
His line of sight switched to the other side of the table.
Señorita Blanca, your situation is somewhat similar to Mr. Brody's. The client you were working for before you joined us, who was it?
Does anyone actually fall for that trick?
She asked. He smiled.
No, but it's all right. We already know.
He picked out a different file, opened it, and scanned the top sheet.
The CIA, in the guise of their Mexico City station chief, Stephen Robinson.
Ananka glanced at Rosario. A slight tensing of her jaw confirmed the man was right.
Politically, the United States is at a very critical point right now. The population is largely polarized. A spark or two in the wrong place, and there will be a wildfire that no one will be able to put out until the country has burned to the ground. Unbeknownst to his employer, Mr. Robinson is a believer in that fire. He thinks that everything needs to be destroyed so that something better can take its place. He also believes he's the one who will ignite that spark. The device you stole would have allowed him to move significantly closer to that goal.
What do I care what happens in the States? They don't care what happens in my country.
Nicely said, but I know you are not that naive. The day after you would have delivered the device, you would have been killed in your own home, taken into the countryside, and buried in a hole no one would ever find.
And how would you know that? Rosario asked.
Because the contract to end your life was arranged through associates of the people I represent. Instead, we made you disappear before you could complete the delivery.
And now you're going to tell me that my client thinks I still have the dongles and is hunting me down to get them back?
Technically, you do still have them. They're waiting with your other things. And yes, Mr. Robinson is trying to find you. Rest assured, he will be taken care of soon enough, and the inquiries into your whereabouts will fade away. The larger problem is that there are others in his organization who know about the devices and will be looking for them and for you. We have a plan for that also.
He closed the file and selected a third.
Fräulein Kessler, first, let me say I'm sorry for your loss. Your employer's death is a tragedy for all those who knew him, but most especially for you.
The woman looked at the screen impassively.
May I ask how your shoulder is feeling? The man asked.
The woman said nothing. The man acknowledged her silence with a sympathetic smile.
As you know, the police possess evidence implicating you in Mr. Wolf's death. We know your only involvement was that you were there when it happened. My regret is we did not anticipate this event and prevent that woman from getting anywhere near him.
It was my job to anticipate, the woman said, not yours.
That's not entirely true. You see, Mr. Wolf was a member of the group I represent, an instrumental member, as a matter of fact. You are here because of his faith in you.
The woman's eyes glistened, but she made no response.
When we realized you had no chance of getting out of your situation without going to trial, we chose to intervene. Naturally, the police have not responded well. Notifications have been sent across the country and back to Germany, asking that you be detained. We are dealing with that, plus working at clearing you of any involvement in Mr. Wolf's murder. It will take time, but it will get done. Until then, the safest place for you is with us. He traded her file for the last in the stack. Miss Ananka.
It's just Ananka.
A bow of his head.
Ananka, then. In your case, the murder was your fault. I'm going to have to take exception to that.
Understandable. We know your intention was not to kill, but you did deliver the fatal dose.
I'm pretty sure you have the details in that little folder of yours, so I don't see the point of going over everything. Besides, you're not my client.
Not at this point, no. The organization that did hire you is currently conducting a worldwide manhunt for you. You are, after all, the killer of the people's candidate.
Dylan spun in his seat, staring wide-eyed at Ananka.
Holy crap! That guy in the Philippines? That was you?
Rosario and the Kessler woman were both now looking at her, too. The former curiously, almost impressed, but the latter with more than a hint of disgust.
Ananka thought about telling them how it had all gone down, but really, why should she care what any of them thought?
To the man on the screen, she said, "My client would have canceled the manhunt as soon as I walked off that airplane with my asshole backstabber of an op leader if you all hadn't stopped me."
Ah, yes, Mr. Perkins. Do you think he was working on his own? That he alone decided to switch the drug you delivered to your target? Who do you think was pulling his strings?
Of course he was working for someone else, which is even more reason for me to turn him over to my client. I didn't say anything about his working for a second employer.
She stared at him and then narrowed her eyes.
Are you trying to tell me my client wanted me to kill Alonzo all along? He was as angry about what happened as I was when I talked to him.
And everyone in your business speaks the truth all the time?
That stopped her for a second, but then she shook her head.
I kill people. It's what I do. If they'd wanted me to kill Alonzo, they would have just said so.
If they had, you would have planned the mission differently, made sure you were nowhere near your victim when he went down. Then your client would have been left without a scapegoat. This way, they have pictures of the killer on the platform with Alonzo. My understanding is that you were to be caught before you could get out of the building. That you weren't is admirable.
Gee, thanks.
But if you want me to believe that the people who hired me were behind it, you're out of luck. I've worked with them for years. We have an excellent relationship.
Even the best soldiers need to be sacrificed at times, but I understand your reluctance, which is why the evidence we've gathered will be made available to you, too.
The room fell quiet, Ananka and her fellow prisoners contemplating what the man on the screen had told them.
It was Ananka who finally broke the silence. Let me get this straight. You saved us and brought us here to protect us. Do I have that right?
In part, yes.
So there is something more?
Of course there's more.
And this more has something to do with why we were kept unconscious until we were all here?
I promise you will be told everything, but before we dive in, I think it would be best for each of you to familiarize yourself with your new quarters and take some time to examine the evidence waiting for you there.
A distant thump echoed from somewhere behind Ananka. This was followed almost immediately by the low whine of an electric motor.
The man stacked his folders into a single pile again.
Follow the hall. You can't miss it. We'll meet again soon.
Wait! You still haven't told us who the hell you are,
Ananka said. An oversight. You can call me Administrator.
Are you serious?
Dylan asked, snickering.
I am, the man said.
Well, Mr. Administrator, I have a question for you. Why are there 5 chairs here when there are only 4 of us?
Simple. The 5th member of your team has not joined you yet.
He started to reach off screen for what Ananka assumed was a disconnect button.
Hold on, she yelled. What do you mean by team?
The man paused. I thought that was obvious. We'd like you to do a job for us.
18. Crestridge Federal Prison, Georgia.
This one guy was a real problem,
Ricky said. His audience was bigger than usual. 5 guys today. His 2 regulars, Tommy and Prance, plus 3 newbies who'd arrived the day before and hadn't had the chance to grow tired of his tales.
I mean, I'd already found all his buddies, but this guy?
He was proven elusive.
Ricky paused when he saw the confused looks on two of the new guys' faces.
Elusive, it means, hard to find.
That seemed to clear things up.
I'd been tracking him for days, way longer than I expected, but finally I corner him at this campsite in upstate Michigan. You know what I'm talking about. A bunch of spots for people to park their trailers and feel like they're roughing it for the night. This was off-season, though, early November, and already really cold, so the place had closed until spring. I knew he was there, though, and I knew he hadn't left because there was nowhere else he could go. But damn if I couldn't find that son of a bitch. I looked through the check-in cabin at the front of the camp. I looked under the cabin. I looked through the surrounding woods. You know where I finally found him?
Tommy and Prance smiled, but kept their mouths shut. After a few moments, the youngest of the newbies, a kid not much more than 18, said, Where?
Well, you remember this was a campground, right?
Nods.
Some people actually use tents instead of campers. If you were staying in one of them and needed to take a piss in the middle of the night, you needed somewhere to go, right? So, there was this row of outhouses off to the side.
What's an outhouse?
Another of the new guys asked.
Where are you from?
New York.
City?
You know it,
he said with pride.
Ever leave the city before? I mean, you know, other than coming here.
Why would I do that?
Ricky grinned.
That explains it. An outhouse is a toilet.
You mean a restroom?
No, a toilet, that's all. The outhouses at this place were small wooden huts with a wooden bench inside that had a hole cut in the top, and below the hole was a pit where the, you know, waste would go.
The new guy's face cringed.
You're making that up.
If only I was. Now, these particular pits had been emptied at the end of summer, but the truth is, you can never completely get everything out. My guy was at the bottom of the one in the center and covered in crap. Literally. You know what literally means, right?
Oh, man, the kid said. That's disgusting.
You haven't heard it all yet,
Ricky said.
Some must have gotten in his nose because as I was walking by, he started sneezing. Must have gone on for a whole minute before he finally stopped and saw me smiling down at him. Let me tell you, getting him out was no fun. Thank God the pipes hadn't frozen and there was still running water in the community showers. Not hot, though. Made him strip down and wash off for 20 minutes, and then put him into the trunk of my car, sans clothes, that means without, and hauled him away. Job done.
He flashed a smile.
Like I told you, Ricky Orbitz always gets his man.
A born showman, Ricky had stretched his story out so that he finished just as the buzzer sounded, signaling the end of yard time. With an,
after you, boys,
he followed the others into line and began the long shuffle back to his cell. As they neared the building entrance, a guard standing off to the side said,
Ricky Orbitz,
and motioned for Ricky to join him. Tommy and Prance gave Ricky a quizzical look.
Beats me, Ricky said. You guys didn't nominate me for Inmate of the Month again, did you?
They shared a laugh, and then he broke from the line and leisurely walked over to where the guard was waiting for him.
Afternoon, Officer Cruz, he said. What is it Ricky can do for you today?
That way.
Cruz pointed down a path that ran along the edge of the yard. Ricky went first, Cruz a step behind him. They walked all the way to the administration building before Cruz again said,
That way,
and pointed at a door Ricky had never used before. Inside, they went down a short hallway that ended at a security door.
Stand to the side, Cruz said.
Ricky stepped to his left.
What's this all about?
No idea.
The guard looked at a camera above the door and said,
Officer Robert Cruz transporting prisoner Orbitz, Richard.
He recited Ricky's prisoner number. In the silence that followed, Ricky said,
Can you at least tell me who you're taking me to?
No idea means no idea.
Officer Cruz, I'm disappointed in your lack of customer service.
The door buzzed. Cruz pushed it open and waved for Ricky to go through.
Aha, Ricky thought as he walked into the new space.
The private visitation rooms. He'd heard about them, but no one had visited him after his incarceration, so he'd had no reason to ever come here before. The hall was wide enough for four people to walk abreast. Five doors were on each side, with windowed upper halves that would allow guards to keep an eye on what was going on inside. No watchers at the moment, though. Cruz led him to the center door on the left. Unlike elsewhere, its window had been covered from the inside. The guard opened the door and stood to the side. Ricky looked at him for a moment, then at the doorway, and then back at Cruz.
Seriously? Not even a hint?
Get in there.
If I get one of those survey cards when this is all done, do not expect me to give you 5 stars.
He stepped through the doorway. The room was disappointingly bland. A table and a few chairs, that was it. There weren't even pictures on the walls. There were, however, 2 people present. Sitting at the table was a woman in sharp business attire. Good-looking, but in a serious way, like she'd forgotten how to have fun. Standing behind her was a man who was all height and muscle. No doubt he was a reminder for Ricky to behave.
Mr. Orbitz, thank you for coming, the woman said.
Lucky for you, I had a meeting canceled.
When he reached the empty chair across from her, she held out her hand.
You can call me Miss Marsh.
He cocked his head.
Miss March?
Marsh, as in swamp.
I like my way better.
He winked. Apparently, it was a joke she'd heard before, because her only reaction was to repeat her motion for him to sit.
So, Miss Marsh, he said as he settled into the chair. Do you visit random prisoners often?
Never.
How lucky am I?
Another wink, and another non-reaction.
Shall we get to business? She said.
You're calling the shots, so whatever you want to do. I would appreciate it, though, if we can stretch this out for as long as possible. It's a nice break from the usual routine, you know what I mean?
Breaking you from your usual routine is exactly why I'm here.
Now you really have my attention.
You are in the first year of a 10-year sentence on federal weapons charges, is that correct?
I believe that's what it says on my paperwork.
What he'd actually been imprisoned for was getting in the way of someone else's operation. There'd been no trial, only an agreement that it would be better for him to do some time than to die young.
Your home is in Chicago?
That's where they forward my mail from.
And you are 38 years of age?
What is age, really, but a mental state?
She tapped an impatient finger on the table.
Answer the question, please.
There are certain documents that claim I'm...
He tried to voice 38, but his lips refused to form the words. That number you mentioned. Apparently that was good enough for her because she moved on.
Your back, please. Show it to me.
My back?
Yes. Specifically, lower back, right side.
Oh, the scar.
Yes, the scar.
He stood, turned around, and pulled up the flap of his shirt. The scar was 1/2 inch above his hip bone and looked like a sideways checkmark.
It had been a gift from a wiry little punk who'd tried to rob Ricky in Nairobi.
Ricky nearly jumped when he felt the woman touch his back. She began pulling at the scar as if it were a sticker. When she let go, she said,
"Thank you."
"You don't want to see my tattoo?"
he asked as he tucked his shirt back in.
"Which one? The leopard on your thigh, or the name under your hair above your left ear?"
Good thing he wasn't looking at her, because he couldn't quite keep the surprise off his face. He didn't think anyone but the tattoo artist knew about the name on his head.
"Either one," he said as he turned back around, his composure restored.
"Tattoos can be faked."
"So can scars."
"Yes, but yours isn't."
"Anything else you want to see while I'm up? I can stand on my hands and walk 10 feet without falling."
"Thank you, but that won't be necessary."
Ricky retook his seat.
"So, did I pass the test? Am I to be a card-carrying member of the Illuminati now? Or does my scar mean I'm next in line for the British crown?"
"You're a funny man," Miss Marsh said, not laughing.
"Well, that's not news."
Miss Marsh stared at him with either mild amusement or borderline disdain.
"I have a piece of paper in my possession that I think will please you."
"Do you? I like being pleased."
Wink number 3. Non-response number 3.
"What do you got?"
"An order for your immediate release."
He didn't even attempt to hide his surprise.
"Excuse me?"
"If you agree to our terms, you will leave with me this afternoon."
"I agree,"
he said quickly.
"You have no idea what you're agreeing to."
I don't care. Anything's better than staying here for the next 9.5 years.
Under the agreement, you will have some independence, but you will not be entirely free.
Sounds great.
You will be working for us, likely to the end of your current sentence.
Employment, too? Who are you, my guardian angel?
If you are ever perceived as more of a problem than as an asset, you'll be put back in a cell.
I'll be on my best behavior.
He crossed his heart and held up 3 fingers in a scout salute. You don't even know what we'll be asking you to do.
All right, I'll bite. What do you want me to do?
Hunt, Mr. Orbitz. Ricky Orbitz, the self-proclaimed best hunter in the world, said,
Where do I sign?
19. Karis Ivanis. Ananka and the others left the conference room in silence, each still processing their first meeting with the administrator. When they rounded the hallway corner, they found a metal wall blocking the way to their cells. On the left side, however, another of the barriers had been lifted. As they turned down the new hallway, Dylan sniffed the air.
What are you doing? Rosario asked.
Trying to see if I can smell the cheese.
There's always some at the end of the maze, isn't there?
No one laughed, not even him. After a few more turns, they emerged into a large rectangular room. A long cafeteria-style table with attached benches sat in the center, while at least 6 widescreen TVs hung from ceiling mounts throughout the space. Ananka had a feeling it would be difficult to find a spot in the room where she wouldn't be able to see at least one of the monitors. Like the round room, this one was surrounded by doors, 2 instead of 3 on each of the 4 walls. A metal placard was affixed to the wall next to each door. The one closest to Ananka read, Liesl Kessler.
Looks like we each have an assigned spot. She looked at the German woman. Liesl, right? This one's yours.
Ananka went in search of her own door, finding it on the wall directly across from Liesl's. Before entering, she checked for any signs the door could be locked via remote control, but the only lock she found was a deadbolt that could only be engaged from the inside. Before entering, she removed her shoes and placed one against the jamb, just in case the door did automatically shut. This was no small cell, but rather an expansive suite. The living room area was big enough to fit 12 people comfortably, and beyond this was an equally large bedroom, complete with king-size bed. There was even a spa tub in the ensuite bathroom. What drew her attention most was the thin black binder lying on the main room coffee table. Beside it were a remote control and a piece of paper that contained instructions on how to access video and audio files through the wall-mounted television. She started first with the binder, reading every word of the 17 pages inside. As the administrator had promised, they detailed how Noah Perkins, Marcus Denton, and Denton's organization had worked together to frame Ananka for Fernando Alonso's murder. But as damning as the evidence was, it could have easily been a set of well-constructed forgeries filled with dreamed-up facts. She picked up the remote and reviewed everything on the list several times. Though video and audio could also be fabricated, in her professional opinion, everything she saw or heard was 100% real. She had no choice but to admit the administrator had been right. Even if she'd captured Perkins and dropped him on Denton's doorstep, her fate would have been served on a platter to the world as Alonzo's assassin. Returning to the common room, she found Rosario and Dylan sitting at the central table across from each other, lost in their own thoughts.
Marked for death? Dylan asked Ananka.
She nodded. You?
Had to check my chest to make sure there wasn't already an X painted on it.
Ananka looked at Rosario, who nodded in confirmation that she was also a member of the should-be-dead gang.
Any sign of Liesl? Ananka asked.
Not a peep, Dylan said.
Ananka walked over to the German woman's room. Liesl had also left a shoe against the jamb. Ananka tapped on the door. When she didn't get a response, she pushed it open and looked inside. Liesl was sitting on the couch, staring at a paused image on her TV screen. It appeared to be a police crime scene photo of a man splayed across a chair, a bullet hole in his forehead.
May I come in? Ananka asked.
Liesl didn't move. Ananka gave it a couple of seconds, then stepped into the room and joined Liesl on the couch.
Tears glistened at the edges of the woman's eyes. "Your boss?" Ananga asked, glancing at the screen.
"He was my responsibility. I'm sure you did everything you could."
Liesl turned to her, her expression blank.
"If I had done everything I could, he would be alive and I would be the one dead."
"Your shoulder wound. You took a bullet for him, didn't you?" Liesl self-consciously touched a spot along her collar.
"It went through me before it hit him. If it hadn't, maybe it would have missed him.
And maybe it wouldn't have.
You tried to save him." "It doesn't matter. He's dead. I didn't do my job."
"Blaming yourself isn't going to solve anything. He wouldn't want you doing that, would he?"
Liesl shot Ananka an angry look before turning back to the television without a word.
Ananka tried to get her talking again, but it was apparent Liesl was done. Ananka returned to the others.
"Still can't believe those bastards were going to kill me," Dylan said after he sat down. "Couriers are supposed to be protected. That's how the system works. No one's supposed to mess with us."
"Couriers die all the time," Ananka said.
"I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm still alive."
"You wouldn't have been if these people hadn't stepped in and saved you." He had no response to that.
"So what do you do?" Ananka asked Rosario.
"What I do is none of your business."
"If we want to get out of here, we'll have to work together, which means what each of us does is all of our business."
"What?" Dylan asked. "We're going to break out?"
"If that's what we need to do."
With a glance at the ceiling, Rosario said,
"You do realize this place has to be bugged."
"I don't care. They may have helped us out of some difficult situations, but that makes me feel thankful, not beholden. I want them to know that I'm not staying here any longer than necessary."
She turned her face toward the ceiling and in a loud voice said,
"In case you didn't hear me, I'm not staying."
A grin brushed the edge of Rosario's mouth.
"I am an obtainer."
The administrator's voice suddenly boomed from an overhead speaker.
"Ananka, would you please join me in the conference room?"
"Alone?" she asked, not sure he would answer.
"If you don't mind."
She shared a look with the others and then rose. "Well, that answers the can they hear us or not question." She stood.
"If I don't come back, you can split the things."
"You do not want us to come with you?"
Rosario whispered, her lips barely moving.
"I have a feeling if we all showed up, they might not let any of us in. Alone, there's the chance I can learn something that can help us."
"Is it us now?"
Dylan asked.
Rosario was the one who answered.
"For now."
Within seconds of Ananka taking her seat at the conference table, the administrator appeared on the video wall.
"Thank you for joining me," he said.
"Did I have a choice?" she said.
"We are not your enemies. No one dragged you here, nor would they have."
Excuse me, but isn't that exactly what you did? I don't remember walking in through the door."
"Our intent has only been to help you."
"You're saying you're my friend then, is that it? I hate to ruin your day, but I have an ironclad rule about not making friends with people who use me."
"We haven't used you."
"Not yet, but you did say something about doing a job for you."
"I did, but I didn't say we'd force you to do that either."
"We would like to hire you."
Ananka laughed.
"Let me guess, and our payment is you having saved our lives."
"Again, incorrect. Saving your lives is not something we did for payment. As for the job, you will each be paid twice your normal rate, in advance. Anyone who chooses not to participate is free to leave.
Into a world where you've already informed those looking for us where we'll be."
He looked caught off guard and even a bit hurt.
"That would be cruel. We would never do that under any circumstances. If any of you chose not to participate, I would urge that person to remain here until his or her particular situation has been dealt with. And before you even ask, staying would not be mandatory. Our commitment to clearing all of your names will continue, no matter what any of you decide."
"Sounds way too good to be true."
"I'm sure it does, but that doesn't change the fact that what I've told you is exactly what's going to happen. But I appreciate you are all cautious by nature. It's what makes you good at what you do.
My words are just talk. Our actions are what will prove to you that we have not been lying.
Ananka leaned forward.
Who are you people? Who we are doesn't matter.
No, it does. A lot.
Why? It has no bearing on the job we hope you will agree to do for us. And I know for a fact you have personally taken on many projects for which you knew little to nothing about your clients.